Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it, put it on your iPod, MP3, computer. Total freedom to listen to it when you have time. Today we have an excellent show as we revisit a line of shows I did earlier in the year where we focus on a particular practice area and how e-discovery can impact it. Judge Facciola and other judges have often commented that e-discovery permeates areas of law. Many lawyers don't recognize this, and it's a good thing for lawyers to be sharing their experiences of how electronic discovery hits their practice area. And today, this show looks at environmental law and how electronic discovery can impact cases which involve environmental issues. This show is particularly special for me because back in 1991, environmental law was a hot area of law. In the midst of that recession, which happened in 91, I thought I wanted to be an environmental law attorney. And it wasn't for altruistic reasons. It was mainly so I could get a job and provide for my family. So I took a number of classes in law school and, in fact, clerked in the field. And so I guess that's a way for me to say there's always been a warm spot in my heart for CERCLA and RCRA. Today's guest is Maggie Boyle, who's e-discovery counsel for Babs Callen Clements & Zomner. It's a Pittsburgh-based law firm with 75 attorneys and 3 offices. And Babs Callen, while known nationally for environmental law, offers a wide range of legal services. In addition to managing the firm's e-discovery department and acting as the firm resource for all e-discovery issues, Maggie's also litigation practice has a litigation practice that focuses on commercial, environmental, and construction matters. She's also a member of the International Legal Technology Association, Women in E-Discovery, the Pittsburgh Organization of Women in E-Discovery and Record Retention, and the Allegheny County Bar Association Technology Committee. So, Maggie, thanks for joining us here on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yes, and you know, I always like to ask first question is how did you become involved in electronic discovery?
Well, I was with an international law firm prior to coming to Babs Callen, and when I was with that firm as a very young associate, just sort of by happenstance, I was tasked with coordinating and managing a large-scale document review on a multi-million dollar matter. You know, I had very, very little experience at the outset there, but sort of by trial and error, you know, learned how to handle such large projects, learned a ton about both hard copy and electronic discovery at that time. You know, this was prior to the amendments to the federal rules concerning electronic discovery. So it was a definite growing area. And I have to say that at the outset, I was really struck by how much I enjoyed the project management aspect of running large scale document reviews and things like that. But at the same time, I was especially intrigued by the electronic discovery portion because of the marriage with law and technology. And it was so new at the time, and people were sort of trying to figure out the best way to handle it. And after my experience there, I really enjoyed it and wanted to do more. So I started getting more involved in these types of projects, you know, obviously track the federal rules as they were going to be amended, and then from there on out have just done all I can do to stay involved in e-discovery, to stay up on e-discovery law, and then, you know, eventually have moved into this e-discovery counsel role. So I'll admit I'm sort of a geek for e-discovery.
And at this point, you know enough to know that it's probably a bad idea to give a young associate a supervisory role. But
yes.
What did we know back then, right? So we're making progress.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, many a time I do think, wow, what was anyone thinking? But I have to say, thankfully, it has gotten me to where I am in my career now. So I'm happy it worked out that way.
Absolutely. So as e-discovery at your firm at Babs Callen, you advise attorneys how to handle e-discovery process in all types of matters. What's one thing that you've noted about e-discovery specific to the environmental context?
Well, you know what's really interesting, Carl, about e-discovery in the environmental world is that most environmental attorneys, I would say, especially those folks involved with regulatory and compliance issues, are much less familiar and much less comfortable with e-discovery than litigators. Although I should probably use the word comfortable very loosely, because as we know, even a lot of litigators are not necessarily comfortable with e-discovery. But I found a lot of the environmental folks, in general, it's just not something they have much experience with. But yet, they are actually generally in a better position to handle and plan for the e-discovery process than litigators are. Because if you think about it,
is that their technical backgrounds that a lot of environmental lawyers have, or? I'll let you answer the question. I'm curious. I'm on the edge of my seat.
I would say I think the technical background certainly plays into it. That's one big thing because, the technical background sort of goes hand in hand with the fact that these attorneys are generally involved in these projects or issues well before litigation arises. So they are there from the outset. And because they're there from the outset, they sort of have an ability to be more proactive. So as you were saying, with their technical information, they can be more proactive as they begin a project or are working through the project without realizing it. They are becoming familiar with the key custodians. They are becoming familiar with how these people manage their information, the types of documents that are important and that are generally used by people working on the projects. They have a sense of where this kind of information is stored, the different systems that are important to the client. So all of those things will become very important down the line in the e-discovery process. Also, I think that environmental attorneys can assist clients in controlling the information on a project. And by that, I mean a couple different things. One thing is environmental attorneys early on, well before litigation, can really help clients be mindful of privilege issues. Because I think they can, sort of remind clients that requests for legal advice, other potentially privileged information should be directed, to the attorneys, to those who need to know. And they can help clients throughout the project make sure that they are limiting that type of information so that it's not something that's there's a waiver or it's not inadvertently sent on to a third party, that type of thing. At the same time, they can also work with clients throughout the project, sort of being mindful that at some point information may be produced, to really think about what goes into email communications and what doesn't. Because I know, we've all been in situations where you have very well-intentioned clients who write something in an email that is very easily taken out of context or very easily misunderstood, and while they don't mean anything harmful by it, it can sometimes be spun that way. So people who are involved in the project throughout can really be helpful in making sure that clients are thinking about this the whole way along, because litigators come in, once the case has generally, a case has been filed or litigation is threatened, and all of this has already happened. So if you have an environmental attorney who's working throughout and is thinking all the time about potential e-discovery issues, that can be really helpful.
Yeah.
Also, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Carl.
Oh, no.
Just one other note along those lines. A lot of these environmental projects have consultants who work on them. And so I think it's really important that throughout the project, an environmental attorney can also work with the consultants regarding the maintenance and handling of company information, company communications, that type of thing.
Interesting. So let's talk about the role that e-discovery typically plays in environmental matter. You care to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think that obviously since the amendment of the federal rules that e-discovery basically comes up in all federal actions, and I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about those in the context of environmental actions, but that's going to be your toxic tort cases, your enforcement defense, your permit appeals, anything that is a federal action is now going to require that you abide by the federal rules, including those regarding e-discovery. At the same time, many states have now developed their own e-discovery rules. And so a lot of the state enforcement actions, other states' citizen suits, cost recovery actions, et cetera, those will also be governed by e-discovery rules. And then there are some states, and this is something that I think people often overlook, there are still a handful of states out there that don't have e-discovery specific rules such as Pennsylvania, for instance, where I practice, there are no e-discovery rules in Pennsylvania state court specifically. However, the Pennsylvania Environmental Hearing Board has e-discovery rules. And so litigators who practice only in Pennsylvania state court actually have less familiarity and less sort of quote-unquote obligations with regards to e-discovery than those environmental attorneys who practice before the Pennsylvania Environmental Hearing Board.
That's interesting. You referenced the federal rules a minute ago. What specifically do environmental attorneys need to know in the federal rules?
I think there are a couple big things that have come out of the amendments that are important. The first one, though, that I really want to focus on is the duty to preserve. The duty to preserve e-discovery is big. There's also a duty to investigate that I think is very important, and then the fact that there's a meet and confer that is required between the parties regarding e-discovery issues is something else that I think parties need to be mindful of and know about, because all of those are going to be important. You know, there are some additional things, but I think those are the big things that people should really be focusing on when they have a federal case or when they have a state case, because many of the state rules, you know, do now mirror the federal rules or are similar to the federal rules with regards to e-discovery.
Well, you know, everyone always likes to know when that trigger starts, the duty to preserve arises in typical litigation. Do you have the same types of questions in the environmental, or is it more clear-cut?
I think it's very much the same. It's the same type of questions, but environmental attorneys are sometimes in a better position to assist the client with that duty to preserve, because, as I was saying a little bit earlier about environmental attorneys really being involved at the outset, when environmental attorneys are involved in projects or issues prior to litigation, they are there. You know, they're intimately involved, they're on site or, you know, working on the project when something comes up that would potentially trigger this duty. Because for litigators, as you know, oftentimes litigators don't become involved or get retained until a lawsuit is specifically threatened or a lawsuit has been filed, where it's not necessarily that way in environmental law.
And actually, just to help, I mean, the environmental lawyers are typically doing what, permitting and compliance with the rules, right? I mean, they're
a lot of times that type of thing, yeah. And so if you take something, let's say a black and white, an easy one is if there's a citizen suit and you get the 60-day notice for a citizen suit, okay, well, that puts you on notice that, I would say there the duty to preserve arises. However, we're talking about permitting issues like you brought up. You know, for example, if you have a case where you're working with an agency back and forth and you have done various drafts of the permit and comments and whatnot have been exchanged, and you and the agency, you think you are sort of on the same page with regards to where your permit is, but then right before your final permit is issued, there is something else, a new component to the permit, to the draft permit from the agency that suddenly is not something that you had contemplated, is not something that, you know, your company is comfortable with, then to you, you say, well, that may very well right now, that may trigger our duty. We're thinking we may need to appeal. And so that's something I think somewhat early on that someone who's involved would be able to say. You know, I was speaking with some other environmental attorneys and someone made a comment about, you know, work they're in a project planning phase right now on something, but they have already sort of received information that citizens are not pleased. You know, they don't even expect to get permits until 2014. But at the same time, you know, there is sort of an inclination to think at this point there will be lawsuits. So now that's where they want to sit down and they really want to think, does that trigger my duty to preserve? So I think that happens much earlier on for environmental attorneys, but I think it's a very good thing because it prevents spoliation. It lets them get out, you know, in front of the issue, and it helps them advise their clients from the very beginning so they're not playing catch-up. They're not running around trying to find documents. They have already done what needs to be done, what they need to do in order to preserve this information.
Interesting. What should the environmental attorneys do to assist the client in satisfying the duty to preserve?
I think the biggest thing that has come, well, actually, let me back up. There are two things I want to say about this that I think are important. Obviously, the duty to preserve requires that automatic deletion policies, et cetera, be suspended. And this goes to all electronic information, as well as hard copy information, of course, that people have. But as we're focused on the specific electronic information, and sometimes in the environmental context, attorneys need to be mindful about specific proprietary environmental systems. You know, there are a number of companies now who have their own environmental data management systems. They have their own particular monitoring systems. All of these types of things. So when attorneys are advising clients that they need to suspend their automatic deletion policies and they need to be retaining all of the potentially relevant information, they need to be aware that this is going to extend sort of beyond just your traditional Word, Outlook, you know, those types of automatic deletions. You need to be thinking about these additional systems that clients may have that may hold information that could be important to the case. But in addition to that, after suspending these policies, a written litigation hold is something that you should definitely advise the clients that they should put a written litigation hold together. That should be disseminated out to all the relevant employees, consultants if necessary, and make sure that your IT department is also aware so that, you know, the automatic deletion policies and such are also going to be suspended.
Do you think that because the environmental attorney is involved in the project, you know, one of the tensions that people have been focusing on, in fact, I know I was just in a meeting, Tom Allman's involved in trying to help amend the federal rules right now, and, you know, one of them is focusing better the litigation hold on a limited number of custodians or trying to sort of rein in the beast a little bit. Do you think the environmental attorneys don't have as much of a problem simply because they're working in the project, they know who the relevant, they can laser in the litigation hold a little bit better than a typical litigator?
I think it's definitely one of the benefits that environmental attorneys have about, you know, sort of this long-term involvement. Now, obviously, I guess I don't want to forget about environmental litigators who may not be involved until, you know, the litigation arises. But for those who are more focused, like we were talking about, the regulatory, the compliance, permitting, that type of thing, I think they are in a good position because they have sort of this firsthand knowledge that will assist them throughout. But as you've mentioned, yes, I think the litigation hold, because, you know, obviously companies want to do what's right and they want to, you know, comply with the rules. But, you know, there is that tension where it gets somewhat excessive when everybody in the company, you know, gets the litigation hold and everybody's saving everything. And I think the more tailored you can make it while being certain to preserve the relevant information, the better off you are.
Yeah, I've always said that's where the process breaks down, right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Because everyone, you know, the company can't believe that you're hearing the lawyer talk. What do you want me to do? At that point, no one's working together. But anyway,
right.
It's interesting. Anyway, all right. Well, you mentioned that the litigation hold should include a description of the types of documents that are to be preserved. Are there specific categories of documents that the environmental attorney should be certain to include?
Absolutely. I know everybody hears the words e-discovery, electronically stored information, and they suddenly think emails. And that's great, and they should. But they need to think beyond that. And sort of beyond that for the traditional litigator is Word, Excel, you know, PDFs, any sort of servers, file sharing type of things. But then what really needs to be focused on even further in the environmental context is a little bit of what we had already mentioned, these environmental data management systems, these monitoring systems. You need to think about lab analysis, any monitoring reports, modeling data. If you're on a project, your project plans, your specs, your drawings, you know, in certain cases for, you know, hazmat related things, your records, your transportation, transportation manifest, invoices, these are all things that are going to be specific case to case. But I think generally in an environmental matter, you instantly have to start thinking sampling, modeling, lab reports, data, et cetera, et cetera.
Does it even get down to like GPS systems if you're, you know, involved with, say, RCRA and you're transporting I guess it depends on the case, but
I would say it certainly can. It's not out of the realm of possibility, I would say.
Huh. Okay. Well, in addition to the duty to preserve, what other obligations do environmental attorneys need to be aware of in e-discovery?
Well, as I'd mentioned before, there's a duty to investigate. And this duty to investigate, I think, again, is something that environmental attorneys are well prepared for without realizing it, because this duty to investigate, in order to properly go to the meet and confer and, you know, meet with the other side and be able to discuss e-discovery issues and electronically stored information issues, you have to understand how your client systems work. You have to understand where the information is stored, who's storing the information, who are the appropriate custodians, et cetera. And if you are the attorney who's been long-term on the project, this is a lot of stuff you already know. Obviously, it may require some additional conversation with IT folks and, you know, additional conversations with in-house counsel, et cetera. You know, I'm not suggesting an environmental attorney should just assume they know and go off from there, but I think that environmental attorneys have a lot of that information already, or they know enough to ask the questions about the additional information. So I think that without realizing it, they are actually well along the way to having all the information that's necessary to comply with this duty and to get themselves prepared.
Okay. Are there any other obligations that arise under the federal rules that apply to the environmental attorneys?
You know, specifically, I think we should touch upon that meet and confer that we talked about a little while earlier. And I guess I will just back up and mention, obviously, I suggest everyone read the federal rules, read the appropriate case law for the environmental world. You know, these are sort of general things. I'm sure in certain cases there are things that would come up that people should be thinking of. But overall, you know, I want people to be thinking about the preservation, the litigation hold, the duty to investigate and understand their client systems, and then hear this meet and confer. And so the meet and confer is really important. And that, again, is not just under the federal rules. A lot of times, state courts have this meet and confer if they have e-discovery rules. And again, here I am in Pennsylvania. I don't have to do it in state court for you, but I do have to in front of the Environmental Hearing Board. I have to meet and confer with the other side. So, you know, put together sort of a report to the court regarding the e-discovery that's going to come up in the case and whatnot.
Does this differ depending on who the parties are? Because I mean, you mentioned citizen suits, but I imagine administrative proceedings are a big part of this as well.
Yes. And, you know, for example, I currently am working on a matter that involves a regulatory agency, but also has a citizens group that has intervened. And the counsel for all of the parties, you know, got together and sat down, and we talked about the format in which we want to produce the information, what works best for everyone else. You know, what can everyone use the formats that we're all talking about? Can we limit the custodians? Is metadata going to be important? What sort of date ranges are there? Can we limit date ranges in some way? In addition to that, you know, what types of ESI do we need to produce and not produce? Do we need to produce, you know, backup tapes, voicemail messages, et cetera? Can we just agree at the outset that none of that's going to be exchanged? In addition, we also, you know, talked about clawback agreement for inadvertently produced information, sort of search methodologies. So we walked through all of that, and I think that, you know, sort of regardless of who the parties are, if you are involved in a federal suit or if you are involved in a state suit in a state that has e-discovery rules or in front of a tribunal that has e-discovery rules, you need to abide by them and you need to be prepared. And so that's something, you know, everyone should.
It's interesting that it appears like it can be like almost three-dimensional chess, because you probably know the citizen suits at the same time as the regulatory proceedings going on, or you can. And that's a little different from if you're dealing with the DOJ or something like that. I mean, you know the suit's coming eventually, probably,
<Right.
laughs> but you don't have the chance to sit down with everyone. Interesting. That can be a very good thing. I mean, this can be very much more streamlined. So.
Well, and I will say that it, again, goes back to the Sedona Conference and what many courts are saying, this real focus on cooperation. Focus on cooperation in the environmental context is the same as the focus on cooperation in any other context that involves e-discovery. You know, parties absolutely 100% should be zealous advocates for their clients. However, as I've heard many of the judges say, be zealous advocates for your clients, but wait until you've cooperated through the discovery process. You know, the discovery process is not the place to break down and fight and scream and be contentious. Let's all work together. Let's all cooperate here. And then advocate as much as you want. Please advocate for your clients, but make sure that you're not, you know, being contentious before that, because we do want to streamline the process. This should just be easier for everybody. We should all be working together and agreeing rather than trying to make this more difficult. It's really beneficial in the long run for everyone if people work together.
Okay. Well, we've talked a lot about the early stages of the e-discovery process, but are there issues or challenges that environmental attorneys have in the review phase? These are the questions that really interest me professionally, but anyway.
Well, I will say that there are some challenging sources that come up in the environmental context that don't necessarily come up in some of the other contexts. As we mentioned earlier, a lot of times in you know, sort of more traditional breach of contract suits, et cetera, that type of thing in the commercial realm, you're going to have your emails, your Word documents, maybe your Excel documents, some handful of things here and there, but they're pretty traditional sources that are generally fairly easy to capture. However, in the environmental context, you know, we have these environmental data management systems. We have all sorts of, for example, CAD drawings. If you have project specs, you have CAD drawings. Well, so one, how do you capture those? And then two, once you've captured them, how are you going to review them and how are you going to produce them? So take something for, you know, CAD drawings, for example. Obviously, you'd want your IT professionals to be the ones capturing them for you. But, you know, you get the CAD drawings, and oftentimes those types of things have free viewers. You can go and you can download a free viewer to be able to read the CAD software. You want to make sure you're thinking about that for purposes of your review, and then you want to make sure you're thinking about that for purposes of production, because if you're sending something to the other side that's a CAD file with no sort of instructions or help on viewing it, I don't think that necessarily, you know, sort of goes along with our discussion on cooperation.
Sure to get a response.
Right.
The heck's this?
So,
not opening in Word. No, I'm joking. You would never, never open a document sent to you in Word. You also mentioned the databases. I mean, it seems to me like the brain, the person, not the tools, are really important in trying to fashion your review. And I think that's true for most cases, but it seems like in the environmental it can be even particularly true.
Absolutely. And sort of along those lines as well, with a lot of the environmental cases, I mean, obviously not all, but many of them do involve the data we were talking about, the lab results, the analysis, the monitoring data. Some of that is so incredibly similar that it can be very difficult to distinguish what is the same and what is different, what's the most updated report versus, you know, what is older information, et cetera. And that's where deduping and near-duping could potentially come into play. You know, if you are in a position where the sides have agreed that you don't need to preserve every single custodian's document if they're overlapping, you know, that's not specifically important to know what a custodian had. You only need to produce one copy of a certain thing. Absolutely, you want to dedupe, but you want to think about maybe near-duping as well. And, you know, there are a lot of programs out there where if you get them, you can run all that information on near-duping software, and then you can take a look and you can actually see what the changes are from document to document, so you can determine which reports are the most recent, which reports are later, what the changes are, which is something that, you know, you may not necessarily need to do for production purposes, but you're going to want to do to prepare your case, and you're going to want to do when you get stuff in from the other side. So I think that that's another way where we've talked about the technology, but also sort of the human interaction with the technology. Think about whether or not these technologies are right for you and if they can help you in your particular case.
Well, do you have any closing advice you'd like to give environmental attorneys for handling the e-discovery process?
No, I think the biggest thing I would say, and it's, you know, across the board, not just in the environmental context, but I can't hammer it home enough. It's sort of my little soapbox that I get on, is plan. You know, be prepared. Be thinking ahead. The e-discovery process is not as complicated as sometimes people make it out to be. it's not easy necessarily, but it is something that is very, very manageable if you sit down ahead of time and you think through the process, you think through the steps, you think through what needs to be done the whole way from the preservation through your collection, your review, and your production. And for environmental attorneys, they can even do that, as we talked about, very well before litigation even arises. If they're thinking sort of, if this could go to litigation, what do I need to be thinking of? And when you're planned like that, it runs much more smoothly, makes the case much easier to handle, and it puts you in a much better position to defend your client or, you know, to advocate zealously for your client when you are on top of things and you really have your arms around the whole process.
But you're forgetting, I think, the most important thing. Don't you want to have someone on your team like yourself, at least, you know, to help make sure you're steering this the right way?
Absolutely, and I appreciate the plug, Carl.
No, but I mean, I think a lot of environmental groups at other firms would not think necessarily to have a e-discovery lawyer involved. And I mean, your firm has a well-known reputation, at least in Pittsburgh, you know, with the entrepreneurial side of doing review and you know, spawning off a FERC-related company. I mean, a very progressive group of people. So I would not suggest it's the norm in environmental groups or environmental firms to be thinking this way. But you've made some great points on how much e-discovery really plays into environmental cases. I hadn't thought about it this way. It's very interesting.
It really does, and I think it goes to your point that that e-discovery is very much across the board, and you're finding it popping up everywhere. And so I think that's why, you know, BAPS Calland is very mindful of, yes, you know, we do a ton of environmental work, have a fantastic environmental practice, and that this is a key component of that, as well as with our litigation practice and with some of the other groups. And I think that this would be good for a lot of firms to think about. You really can offer your clients a service by having a dedicated resource, being able to streamline the process, making sure that there's someone who can answer the questions and doesn't have to spend all the time on the research, you know, someone who knows and can get the ball rolling and take it and run. And I think that that adds a lot of comfort, both for attorneys who don't do e-discovery as their main function, as well as for clients. And it also adds a lot of cost predictability that doesn't come in areas in which people are not as familiar and are sort of just doing it every time a little bit differently. So, the environmental context, like everything else, is becoming beholden to e-discovery. So I guess that's a good thing for you and for me, Carl.
Yeah. Well, Maggie, thanks for joining us on ESI Bites. And I didn't make a big deal that you followed Judge Groom and Judge Facciola yesterday. I didn't want to throw they were your opening act.
I know.
But you did. This was a good show. It was good to hear your thoughts. And it's always a pleasure to have you on and share your knowledge with us and our listeners. And hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com for a complete list of our shows. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, Easy Bites. That's the way it sounds out of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.